Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Jaya Prabhupada.
So Prabhupada Ki Jai, Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we are doing text 13 from Canto 9, Chapter 13, and it's entitled The Dynasty of Maharaj Nimi. Rajno Jivatu Dehayam Prasannaha Prabhavo Yadi Tateti Ukte Nimihi Praha Ma Bunme Deha Bandhanam Ajno Jivatu Dehayan. Prasannaha Prabhavo Yadi Tateti Ukte Nimihi Praha Ma Bunme Deha Bandhanam Rajno Jivatu Dehayam Prasannaha Prabhavo Yadi Tateti Ukte Nimihi Praha Ma Bunme Deha Bandhanam. Please chant. Rajno Jivatu Dehayam Prasanna Prabhavo Yadi Tateti Ukte Nimihi Praha Ma Bunme Deha Bandhanam. Rajno Jivatu Dehayam Prasanna Prabhavo Yadi Tateti Ukte Nimihi Praha Ma Bunme Deha Bandhanam. Rajno Jivatu Dehoyam Prasanna Prabhavo Yadi Tateti Ukte Nimihi Praha Ma Bunme Deha Bandhanam. Ajno Jivatu Dehoyam Prasanna Prabhavo Yati Tateti Ukte Nimihi Praha Ma Bunme Deha Bandhanam. And the word for word, Rajna of the king, Jivatu, may again be enlivened. Dehai Ayam, this body, now preserved, Prasanna, very much pleased. Prabhavaha, all able to do it. Yadi, if. Tata, let it be so. Iti, thus. Ukte, when it was replied by the demigods. Nimihi, Maharaj Nimihi. Praha, said. Ma bat, do not do it. Me, my. Deha bandhanam, imprisonment, again, in a material body. In the translation, if you are satisfied with this sacrifice, and if you are actually able to do it, do so, kindly bring Maharaj Nimi back to life in this body. The demigod said yes to this request by the sages, but Maharaj Nimi said, please do not imprison me again in a material body. In the purport by Srila Prabhupada, the demigods are in a position many times higher than that of human beings. Therefore, although the great saints and sages were also powerful brahmanas, they requested the demigods to revive Maharaj Nimi's body, which had been preserved in various perfumed balms. One should not think that the demigods are powerful only in enjoying the senses. They are also powerful in such deeds as bringing life back to a dead body. There are many similar instances in the Vedic literature. For example, according to the history of Savitri and Satyavan, Satyavan died and was being taken away by Yamaraj, but on the request of his wife, Savitri, Satyavan was revived in the same body. This is an important fact about the power of the demigods. Om Agyana Timarandasya Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Namom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimata Ramapada Swami Iti Namine Namom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimata Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschacha Desha Tarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Panchakalpa Taribhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyeva Cha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnubhyo Namo Namaha. So just to look back on the situation that has brought about this particular point in the narration. Maharaj Nimi began performing great sacrifices, and since the priest he'd requested to assist him, Vasishtha Muni, had already agreed to be the priest performing a sacrifice for Lord Indra, Maharaj Nimi appointed another priest, or priest in the plural. And here, in this verse, the other priests that he'd appointed, including the sages, they're making a request of the demigods. And these are their words. If you are satisfied with this sacrifice, and if you are actually able to do so, kindly bring Maharaj Nimi back to life in this body. Maharaj Nimi had been cursed by Vasishtha for not having waited for him to return from his performing sacrifices in the heavenly planets, and particularly for Lord Indra. And Maharaj Nimi, he'd responded by becoming angry at being cursed, and he'd counter-cursed. And as a result of this cursing and counter-cursing, both had died. So both Vasishtha and Maharaj Nimi. Now, the situation at the point that we're in here is that King Nimi's body had been preserved in fragrant chemicals. And when the sacrifice was over, the priests prayed for Nimi's life to all the demigods who had come to the yagya. Now, a body without consciousness is understood to be a dead body, and it means that as soon as consciousness is removed from the body, the ears can't hear, the mouth won't speak, the eye will not see, and it means that all the senses that reach out into the world to acquire knowledge, they don't function anymore. And it also means that other working senses, like the legs, the hands, the voice, actually doesn't work. Now, consciousness is absolutely necessary for the animation of the body. And there's a simile that's used to explain consciousness. Just as smoke is a symptom of fire, so consciousness is the symptom of the presence of the soul. very nice simile is given in a very teeny book that sometimes is used in book distribution, Beyond Birth and Death. So it's a very excellent simile for drawing attention to the symptom of the presence of the soul, namely consciousness. Now, it means that the energy of the soul is produced in the shape of consciousness. And the priests, they are praying to the demigods for the body that's there without consciousness and this body that's immersed in fragrant balms to become animated again. And it's interesting just looking at what's the condition of that body. Now, there's a whole mixture of chemicals that are used to embalm a body. And these chemicals then allow for the preservation of the physical elements and prevent their decomposition. So typically, those chemicals, they're listed. there's formaldehyde. There's something called glutaraldehyde, methanol, humectants, and wetting agents, and some other solvents. So these are that is what it was present in this embalmed body of Maharaj Nimi. And in fact, these chemicals can preserve a body indefinitely. So generally in society, the body is embalmed just for a short period of time to allow for the body not to be offensive to those attending a funeral. Because naturally there's a stench with decomposition and the structure doesn't remain the same as decomposition happens. I mean, I often have this experience with vegetables in a refrigerator. Even though the cold retards decomposition, if it's left for too long a period of time, you'll see the vegetable is sometimes shrunken, so it's lost its shape, it's all shriveled, or alternatively, a nice bright green leaf has sort of yellowed and looks very miserable because it's not standing in a perky manner anymore. Now, generally, without the presence of embalming fluid, a human body takes 8 to 12 years to decompose. And coming to the point of just the skeletal structure. So how this is done, so this is interesting. I'm just drawing attention to this because it's interesting what is the condition of the body even with it being embalmed. It means that actually all the blood is first drained out. So the living fluid is removed, usually from the heart, and then once that fluid is removed, then through an artery, all these chemicals are injected. So the body is literally internally pumped up with all these chemicals. So that's the condition of Maharaj Nimi's body. In fact, there's 2 gallons of that fluid that's needed in the body to embalm it. Now, all the material elements are there, and they're asking the demigods if it's possible to rejuvenate the body, or the consciousness in particular. So now, if we go back a little bit about Maharaj Nimi, he's described as being expert in the science of spiritual knowledge. And this is the reason that's given for why he was able to give up his body. So the giving up of the body, so taking into account that it's the soul that's dictating, it's akin to giving up an old garment. It's just the external covering. So this is given in a very straightforward way by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So, in actual fact, it's that atomic individual soul that is transferred into another body. And this is made possible, Srila Prabhupada writes, by the grace of the super soul. And it's the super soul that residing within the heart alongside the soul, that source of energy within the heart, who's fulfilling the desires of the individual soul. So being expert in the science of spiritual knowledge, which is how Maharaj Nimi is referred to, means that one's acting under the dictation of super soul. And so this is actually a very perfect stage in the yoga system when a devotee in Krishna consciousness is acquainted with Krishna within the heart. And that perfect stage means that the devotee is acquainted with Krishna within the heart, and he's also externally taking the help of the spiritual master. So that's the perfect stage. And so the fact that Maharaj Nimi is referred to as being expert in the science of spiritual knowledge would indicate that he is acquainted with this principle of transcendental loving service, and which is the yoga system of Bhakti Yoga. So Srila Prabhupada writes that when someone rises to this stage of receiving dictation from the Lord, that is actually a greater stage than any stage of material achievement that a yogi even could achieve. So not even referring to regular material achievements, but even that a yogi can achieve. So for example, below that achievement might be the achievement that a very accomplished yogi that's not rendering transcendental service will be achieving. And those 8 super achievements of the yogi are that kind of control of the physical elements, so being able to become very light, or even lighter than air, or smaller than an atom, or bigger than a mountain, or even being able to achieve whatever that yogi desires, including being able to control the elements in the way that the Lord controls the elements. Now, Maharaj Nimi is he is particularly conscious of the temporary nature of the body, which in turn means that the life of consciousness within the material body, it's very flickering. So this hyper-awareness that Maharaj Nimi had is what dictated his choice in proceeding with sacrifices, as opposed to waiting for the return of his spiritual master from the heavenly planets, where he was overseeing his sacrifice with Lord Indra. So now there's a point to be looked at in terms of the position of the spiritual master in relation to what's described here, the performance of sacrifice. And there's an interesting statement that's made actually by Advaita Acharya, and he says, "My spiritual master should never accept charity from rich men of king or kings, because if a spiritual master accepts money or grains from such materialists, his mind becomes polluted." This is from a very nice book, The Guru and What Srila Prabhupada Says. So this quote from Advaita Acharya. And this is actually the accusation of Maharaj Nimi, the accusation that he levels at his spiritual master after he was provoked. He says, "For the sake of getting contributions from the King of Heaven, you have lost your spiritual intelligence." So this was his accusation. Thus his view actually was that his spiritual master had forgotten his duty as a bona fide spiritual master, means that he was forgetting to give instructions to Maharaj Nimi that was in line with the super soul's instruction, because that's the purpose that the spiritual master, or the service that the spiritual master is rendering. So this was Maharaj Nimi's view. So via the Vedic system, the receipt of charity by a sannyasi or a brahmana is done because it affords those giving charity to free themselves from sinful reaction. So that is the reason the spiritual master is accepting charity. It's because of the benefit that the persons are giving their charity are gaining. They're freeing themselves from sinful reactions. So the problem that happened in the case of Maharaj Nimi and Vasishtha Muni is that Maharaj Nimi saw that the recipient of charity, Vasishtha Muni, so sannyasi or spiritual master, was turning his attention to the extent of the remuneration. And hence he was giving preference to performing a sacrifice for Lord Indra where the remuneration would be greater. So that is why there was the criticism or the accusation leveled by Maharaj Nimi to Vasishtha. He'd forgotten the purpose of receiving charity. So so again, Maharaj Nimi is referred to as somebody who's expert in spiritual understanding. And so he was pointing to very important principles. And that is that these acts of sacrifice and charity require having the proper perspective. So Krishna puts it this way. Acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance should be performed without attachment or any expectation of result. That means that there was some expectation of result on the part of Vasishtha Muni. So they, and Krishna continues, they should be performed as a matter of duty, O son of Pritha. That's my final opinion. Krishna talking in the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the 16th verse. And I'll just read it. Itani api tu karmani sangam tyaktva falani cha katavayaniti me parta nishchitam matam uttamam. Now, in line with the acquaintance of Maharaj Nimi with religious principles, the sages request the demigods to allow for the animation of Maharaj Nimi's body. And that's also in order, that request. The demigods are the controlling deities of physical elements. And they're also the empowered expansions of Lord Vishnu. So that means that they're all very great devotees of Lord Vishnu, and they are entrusted with to ensure different functions of universal affairs. they have limitations because they're embodied also, and they're embodied by time. There's the external energy that can act upon them, and they also have only partial consciousness of the Supreme. So there are limitations with the demigods. And it's interesting to, because of these, some limitations on the part of demigods, there's also the fact that a devotee is not actually controlled by demigods. Because they are functioning as assistants to Lord Vishnu, and so they are respectful to the responsible position of the devotee. And they're very also aware of their responsible position that they've been appointed to by the Supreme Lord. And here it is that they're agreeing to the request made of them by the sages of animating the body of Maharaj Nimi. So they actually have the power to do so. And Srila Prabhupada puts an emphasis on this. Now, different demigods have different powers. For example, Lord Indra has the power to shower the earth and to enhance the vegetation. And it's interesting, there's always the manner in which the ruling is done. So Lord Indra, he rules the vegetation with a thunderbolt in his hand. The vegetation, but he's holding a thunderbolt for the vegetation. Now, there's an example also of Lord Indra using his power to kill a demon. So this was some time back. We actually covered it in one section. He kills a demon, Namuchi, when his thunderbolt fails to actually pierce the neck of Namuchi. This is in the fight between the demons and the demigods. And so he actually sits down and he meditates. So it's again, it's connecting with Super Soul. And he understands that actually a very special kind of weapon needs to be used to kill this particular demon. And so he creates a weapon that's made of foam. And because this particular demon could not be killed by anything moist or dry, so Lord Indra had that power to actually create a weapon made of foam that actually was lethal. So it's a special power, clearly. It's not merely the foam. And now, each of the demigods, so it's Surya, Chandra, Varuna, they've got their particular powers. And Yamaraj, in particular, has a very interesting power, because he has control over human beings, but he doesn't have any control over animals. So every demigod has a particular department that he's dealing with. So in the case of Yamaraj, he has control over humans because humans have that consciousness to distinguish right from wrong. And and in fact, it means that he has to make a distinction between those who are punishable and those who are not punishable. And anyway, I'll share this. For some time in my mind, I've found myself examining, like knowing that a particular person has committed a terrible act. And I found myself examining, going backwards and forwards, of the act is terrible, yet there's some circumstances that have to be taken into account in terms of the person's capacities. And so I'm realizing it must be an incredible task that Lord Yamaraj has to perform to actually weigh up who's punishable and who isn't punishable. Now, yeah, and this, you know, I'm getting some appreciation just from personally looking at one instance that I've been exposed to. Now, his messengers, the Yamadutas, they actually state the criterion that needs to be met for determining persons who are punishable. And that criterion is very nicely explained when the Yamadutas speak about Ajamil. So they say, this man Ajamil did not undergo atonement. Therefore, because of his sinful life, he must be taken into the presence of Yamaraj for punishment. So that's the criterion, whether atonement has been done or not. So that's very helpful, just thinking when one sees that there's remorse on the part of a person committing a grossly sinful act, then, you know, one can actually think, oh, okay, some help can be given. Or, but if there's no remorse or no attempt at atonement, then one understands punishment has to be there to bring it to the person's consciousness. So and Yamaraj was brought up by Srila Prabhupada in this purport. So I'm just going to mention that Yamaraj is described in the following way by Sukadev Goswami. The omnipotent Yamaraj is as good as Lord Brahma, for while situated in his own abode or in everyone's heart, like the Paramatma, he mentally observes the past activities and thus understands how the living entity will act in future lives. Thus, Yamaraj actually has the complete cooperation of the Supreme Lord. And therefore, by the grace of the super soul, he can see past, present, and future of the living entity within. So he makes decisions actually in consultation with the super soul. It's interesting when you realize how close is the relationship of the demigods with Lord Vishnu, just by virtue of the fact that they're so in touch with the super soul. And persons that are just looking for some enhancement of material body or enhancement of material circumstances, and they look to the demigods for that purpose, they do indeed obtain material opulence. So that takes the form of maybe having many animals, having riches, having beautiful rivers close to where they're residing, having beautiful wives, having many followers. But if those material opulences are granted by the demigods, it doesn't mean that they're actually coming to understand the Supreme Lord. So there is that what would be the word? I guess shortage in their receipt of the material opulences, the failure to understand the Supreme Lord. It doesn't come with the increased opulences through their worship of demigods. And Maharaj Nimi, however, he makes a request to the demigods. And he asks that he not be placed in a material body. The usual way of worshipping the demigods is to ask for material opulences, you know, like a better, more beautiful body. And Maharaj Nimi is just asking, don't put me in a material body. So that's his request to the demigods. So there's a discrepancy. The sages are asking for that formaldehyde laden body to be revived, consciousness to animate that body. Again, Maharaj Nimi be present in that body. And Maharaj Nimi is asking that please don't actually place me in a material body. So we can see again, you know, he's described as having been very expert in spiritual knowledge. So he's quite clear. Now, he's able to see that the material body has a limited duration, and it means that it's also subject to the whims of death. And of course, taking into account what I've described about Yamaraja's role, we can say that Maharaj Nimi has nothing actually to fear, because he's engaged in transcendental service to the Lord. And that means that although if he were to be in a temporary body in the material world, he would be engaged in Krishna's service. So, in fact, it can be said that from a devotee's perspective, everything that's material is being seen in relation to the Lord is actually spiritual. So that body could be considered spiritual. And so actually what the important thing that's emerging is that the mentality of service overrides the material body. And so one could say that the request on the part of the sages is in order, and one could say that Maharaj Nimi's concern is there, but due to his expertise in rendering transcendental devotional service, it wouldn't be a problem were he to be in a material body, and he wouldn't be under the purview of one of the demigods, namely Yamaraj. So these were just some simple thoughts, because the next verses will be elaborating further upon Maharaj Nimi's particular deep understanding of the nature of the material body. So this is what this verse allowed. If there's any thought to expand the discussion.
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. Thank you for always preparing. Obviously you prepare, so thank you. One thing that you brought to mind that you mentioned related to this verse is that you quoted from the Gita 2:22. When a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, etc. So in light of this verse where Maharaj Nimi says, I'm imprisoned in this body. So that reminds me that these are not just garments, they're straitjackets or shackles. So that just came to mind. But my comment or my question is, one thing I appreciate about being imprisoned in a material body is one passage in the Bible, one of my favorite passages in the Bible, it's in the book of John, chapter 8. Jesus told some descendants, Abraham's descendants, you know the verse where it says, the truth will set you free. Jesus says, if you follow my teachings, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So then Abraham's descendants arrogantly responded. They said, We are Abraham's descendants. We're descendants of royalty. And we have never been slaves of anyone. So how can you say we should be set free? We're already free. So then Jesus enlightened them. He said, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. So I appreciate it because it's described that we're slaves of lust. Like in a previous verse, they tried to control their senses, but they couldn't. They ditched our seeing when they saw Urvashi. So I appreciated that. So another comment that I appreciate is that in the material world, like I was mentioning earlier, is that this world is described as Durga, prison. And it seems like one of the greatest diseases when we come to the material world or in prison is that I'm in control. But in prison, we never see anyone go into prison and tell the guards, I'm in control. You're being strip searched. And so my question is how to give up this mentality that we're in control, because we can see that in the pastimes of people who even had the association of Krishna, like Indra you were mentioning. What did he think? In Govardhan Lita, I'm in control. He said, I'm in control. He tried to kill the residents in Vrindavan. He tried to kill Krishna, but then he was humble. He wasn't in control. Or Durvasa Muni, I'm in control. He tried to kill Ambarish. So we could easily see that we're controlled by lust, we're controlled by anger. I'm a writer, I like to write all the time. But sometimes, I mean, Krishna's given the ability, I could write all day if I want to, but I notice in my own consciousness that even when I want to write, time takes over, I have to go to sleep or I have to eat. So then I realized that I'm a slave of time, I'm a slave of food. It's not just food, it's not just time. You're actually in prison. And so how to give up this mentality, because if, like I said, even if the devotees who had association with Krishna arrogantly thought I'm in control, then what's to speak of devotees in our modern time? So how to give up this mentality that I'm in control, we're not in control, then I kind of had another point, but maybe you could expand on that, related to that point. I didn't get it all through because I talked too much, so sorry.
That's very good. You had brought up an example from, I guess, the Bible that illustrated that from the point of view of Jesus, that persons are prisoners due to their sinful acts, and you had also highlighted in your personal life the awareness of being under the control of time. So it's not the favorite activity could not continue indefinitely. There were the necessity for taking care of the physical body curtailed the activity. So you had raised the question, how to help a mentality that one is in control when taken into account, as you pointed out, that I'm just inferring and making the connection with your earlier two statements, taking into account that there is that imprisonment both by one's sinful activities and imprisonment by the necessity of body care, even if the activity may be a favorite one and isn't sinful. I mean, it's a very positive work-related activity. So, yes, giving up the mentality of being in control. I mean, more than anything, the mentality of service is what needs to replace the mentality of being in control. So that mentality of service is has to be nurtured, and a way of nurturing it is to actually take into account the various activities one is performing and actually consciously perform those activities in the most excellent, the most thoughtful, the most careful way possible, thinking all the while that one is performing that activity as a kind of loving service to the Supreme Lord. So thinking in that way means that there's always a respect for the time factor. So it becomes clear there's a beginning point and there's an end point to every activity, because it becomes a sacrifice. It's a perfect, rounded, complete something that one is offering to the Supreme Lord. So I'll give you an example. Say in devotional life, it's very nicely arranged that external activities are under the purview of time. So for instance, one may have maybe performing a loving service to the Supreme Lord through cooking a meal. Now, there's a set time when the deity has to be offered a meal. So it means that one, with great concentration, careful planning, goes through all the actions necessary to compose maybe 5 or 6 different dishes. So it means in advance one's thought of the ingredients, one set them up, one goes through the stages for each dish. Perhaps it's, you know, chopping, boiling, sauteing, but each dish has this particular series of steps. And then at the end, all those steps are concretized in the form of a completed preparation. So just by actually having that service mentality in performing the action, it actually leads to a respect for time. And the respect for time is such that one is doubly conscious that Krishna is time. He's permitting the usage of one's body, one's mental strength, one's intelligence within a time frame for a sacrifice. So the same thing in one's work activities, the fact that it takes on with a service mentality the nature of a sacrifice, there's respect for time. So the particular offering then is made complete and perfect, knowing that, okay, within this time between bathing, between eating, I'm making a sacrifice. So, and then in terms of the control factor dissipating just by virtue of the fact that one understands the reactions for previous sinful activities, that one is easier, because it's the punishment that's coming, those reactions to sinful activities, and it may take many different forms. Sometimes it's very subtle. It may just be a simple case of, you know, not feeling happy or feeling some loss or feeling some grief. Those are sinful reactions. So because of going through those sinful reactions, the mind is being beaten into submission. One actually fervently prays to be released from that state. That even if it's a subtle mental state, one prays to be released from that. And that is what's actually casting such a blow at that egotistical part of being in control, because one is already going through punishment just by living with some mental state that's of a negative nature. So I think it's inbuilt. The blows at the control mentality, it's inbuilt, just if one intelligently looks at the condition that one is going through. So those are some thoughts. Go ahead, Jai Baladev, you had another thing.
Appreciate your whole point, and especially that last point you mentioned, that we're kind of beat. Naturally, we undergo this slave mentality because our previous sinful activity. So I appreciate it at that point. I'll kind of relate it to my last point. You can expand on it if you like, but one point I always try to keep in mind is that naturally there's tolerance and respect for authority figures. Like in prison, you're not going to spit in a police face, or if it's a rich donor, because that's the material world. We have to tolerate people and respect people, but it's easy to respect authority figures like police or your professor. If I don't like my professor, but I have to tolerate. Or if it's a rich donor, I'm not going to say, you guys are materialistic, you know, you're so simple. Can we get a donation still? That's not going to happen. So my question is how to get with this mentality that we can see in the material world is that I only respect people if I know they're superior to me. And if they're not, but we can see that that's not the case in the scriptures, just like King Rahugana. He was a king, but he showed was very inconsiderate and intolerant, disrespectful towards Jalabharta, who looked like a homeless person. So that's the tendency in the material world. I'm in control. Okay, I'm only in control so far if it's authority figure. But we can see that, you know, you'll still get reaction from simple activity. So how to keep that in mind, that aspect that actually, you know, you should tolerate everyone, because if you don't, then there might be some reaction. And I know that in my personal life, that whenever I try to slander a devotee's character, you know, I would get a reaction. I washed a lot of dishes, so I got a lot of hand cuts. So I always wash the knives first, and then I could slander. So maybe you could explain a little bit about that. I mean, how to keep that in mind. That's what I keep in mind. I mean, everyone's free to choose what they want, but that's some points I appreciated from the shastras that we could I could take inspiration from. So
so the observation you were making is that how easy it is to actually be respectful or attentive to persons in superior positions, but maybe not so much, I'm inferring, where if persons are not necessarily in that position. So just you were commenting this, and so and even making a note that in your case it became apparent reactions if there wasn't that respect or regard given to those that were devotees, even if their position wasn't one of superiority. So, yeah, it's a very, I guess, maybe obvious kind of thing, that persons in position of authority do command respect. But persons may not be trained to actually give respect. So you may find that even persons who are in positions of authority may not be respected, because the persons that should be giving the respect don't know how to do that or haven't been trained to give respect. So like heard this interview once. It was a person who had come from my country of origin, South Africa, and had been, I think, a swimming champion, an international Olympic swimming champion, and the person ended up by marriage becoming a princess of Monaco. And so the person was being interviewed by somebody with a South African radio station, but the person didn't have proper respect in interviewing the princess. So the person was trying to be humorous and too casual. So the person was referring to the princess in a sort of joking way, "Your Serene Highness." He could have said, "Your Highness so-and-so," but he was referring to her as "Your Serene Highness," and then trying to bring up things that were familiar culturally with her, but not with the proper regard, more in a kind of joking mood. And I remember feeling a little shocked hearing the interview, because it was so apparent that there was over-familiarity, because the person was no longer the girl next door or from a small town in South Africa. The person was now in a different position. The person was in a royal position. The person was together with her husband, they're ruling a small kingdom that commands the respect of all nations, because it's the one and only state in the world that has no debt whatsoever. So it's extremely, maybe, but well, apparently it also has the highest percentage in the world of wealthy persons residing there, and also Monaco. And so it indicates to me that persons need to be trained to know how to give respect. So in that country, the subjects are invited to a grand picnic, all the subjects that the king or the prince and the princess actually put on for all their subjects. So they actually put on a picnic for the entire population in some huge stadium once a year. And one can see that there's, even though that would imply that there's familiarity with the subjects, the king and or the prince and the princess are treated by their subjects in an extremely deferential way. So this interview, just by virtue of the fact of a similar nationality and knowing the town, the origin of the princess, allowed for some interviewer to be way too familiar. So that person needed some training in how to deal with a princess, how to deal with a person in rulership, a person running a state. So that's one point. It's necessary to be trained in how to give respect, because it's not automatic. Persons may not know how to, and because they may not have a proper perception or understanding of the position of somebody. I mean, you gave the example of a policeman, so a criminal is not necessarily respectful of a policeman in the core of his heart, but in the presence of a policeman, he may not actually be performing the activities he generally performs, such as, you know, stealing somebody's possession or bashing somebody over the head in the visible presence of the policeman. But he may continue that activity outside of the presence of the policeman. It doesn't mean he's respectful to the policeman. Still needs to be trained. And the training is, in that case, through, you know, having to go through the suffering, the reaction for the sinful activity performed. So suffering and reaction is very educative. And very educative. And you pointed out that same fact yourself, that you were able to make the connection between a reaction and the activity, the action you'd performed, that may not have been sufficiently respectful to a devotee of the Supreme Lord. So yeah, there needs to be some training, but naturally the punishment is highly educative. So thank you very much. Thank you for your kind attention. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.